reform source told Press TV that the talks on the revival of the nuclear deal will collapse if the U.S. continues refusing to remove all the U.S. sanctions that violate the 2015 nuclear deal. At least two rockets landed on airbase hosting U.S. forces in western Iraq. That's the third attack on bases housing American troops in the past couple of days. And the Scottish First Minister is challenging British Prime Minister to oppose another independence referendum through legal actions. She says only courts could prevent such a vote. Hi, everybody. You're from Tehran with me, Behrouz Najaf. It's good to have you with us. Now, let's just start with the top story for this hour. An informed source has told Press TV that talks on the revival of the nuclear deal will collapse if the U.S. continues refusing to remove all the imposed, reimposed, and relabeled sanctions against Iran. The source says that Iran demands full compliance with the deal and the removal of all sanctions imposed since its implementation. Based on paragraph 29 of the deal, the U.S. must also remove all obstacles to the normalization of Iran's trade ties with the world. Press TV has learned that the U.S. still refuses to make adjustments that would reduce the risk of economic and banking relations with Iran. The source says that this constitutes a blatant violation of paragraph 29 of the deal. Iran considers the U.S. failure to remove sanctions on specially designated individuals and entities that have been targeted under other labels. So on the phone for us from Tehran, we have Sam Tarabi, director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute. Good to have you with us. So what's your take on this? What's going on? And what do you expect to come next?
Well, you know, this is actually a continuation of what we've been seeing throughout this whole process, which is that the Americans are not capable of implementing what they had agreed to. Of course, this was something that many of the critics of the JCPOA in Iran were pointing out when this whole process started out, but the process proceeded, the agreement was signed, and then, of course, all those things that many in Iran had said actually happened, which is that Trump was elected, he tore up the deal, as far as the Americans were concerned, and even before that, during the Obama administration, the deal was never really implemented the way that they had agreed to it. So we're back at that point, this time with the Biden administration. This is the final chance, as was officially stated by Dr. Zarif a couple months ago to the members of the JCPOA. And it is very unlikely that the Americans are able to implement it the way they agreed it to, and that has to do with American domestic issues, which is that, number one, this agreement can never be taken to the Congress for it to be ratified and made into a treaty, which would then make it very difficult for a future president to break it, as happened with Trump, because immediately the Congress would reject this treaty, given the domestic politics that exists in the U.S. And the second thing is that, as you know, your report was mentioning, that there are things as it relates to the so-called normalization of economic relations, which are things that were never going to happen, or the Americans and the West never had the intention of allowing these to happen. And so, of course, now Iran is in a position of strength. It's proof to the world that it abides by its agreements. And, you know, there's nobody in the world that will say now that Iran didn't abide by it. And it's clear to everyone that the West, and especially the Americans, are not abiding by it, but also the Europeans. They didn't abide by the agreement. So this is their final chance. It's the 4th of May today. 8th of June, we have elections in Iran. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a different government. Of course, given what has happened in the last couple of weeks concerning Dr. Zarif, it's also clear that, and of course, that's also why he didn't go to Vienna, because there was maybe the thought in Iran that even if the government ends, by sending a technical delegation and by sending the deputy, it would be independent of that change of government if there was going to be some things happening. But it's looking as though there's not going to be those things happening that the Iranians are demanding, because the Americans can't do it. There might be some people in the U.S. who want to, but the reality is that Americans can't do it. This is what we told a lot of people in Iran when they started this process. Of course, they insisted. And now this is where we're at. And the 8th of June, there's going to be a very different situation.
You're saying that America cannot do it. So why should they take the trouble and get engaged in this and to claim that they want to revive it and take all the trouble and ask the Europeans also to take part? And they also pitched in themselves. So why should they take the trouble and start, you know, pushing for negotiations, and the third round is over, they're going for the fourth round? If they're not able to do it, why do they push for it?
Because they don't understand Iran. They think that Iran needs the agreement, and so somehow it will somehow, you know, compromise and you know, accept something less than what was agreed to. Of course, we know that even the original agreement fell short of what the Supreme Leader had demanded. He very clearly and openly in his letter stated that there had to be 9 conditions for Iran to accept the deal. Dr. Zarif and the negotiators came back saying they couldn't get all of them. Iran proceeded nevertheless to show its goodwill. So it's never been the case that the Americans were going to do what they said they were going to do, because the process was not simply about the nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. It was about trying to get Iran to give up an important part of its strategic power and capabilities as it relates to nuclear energy and nuclear power and the whole cycle of nuclear energy production. And this being the preliminary act to getting Iran to give up its missiles, to give up its regional influence, and all the other things that they always keep listing, and whether it was the Obama administration or the Biden administration now that's talking about all the little things that they want. So for them, it was not about what the Iranians wanted. It was about trying to reduce Iran's power. Obviously, that failed. They even killed Qasem Soleimani in this time in order to try to do that. That backfired even more. So it's about Iranian power. It's not about economics, as some people think in Iran. It's not about the nuclear process. It's about Iran becoming strategically going under the flag of the Americans, as was clearly stated by the Supreme Leader in his last speech when he talked about why it is that the West is always upset when Iran does independent things, whether it's with its neighbors or with China or with Russia. Right. They want Iran to go back to the time of Qajar. They want Iran to go back to the time of the Pahlavi regime and not be an independent power that doesn't do everything with America's power like the other allies in the region that the U.S. has.
Okay, thank you very much for the thorough explanation and contribution. Sam Tarabi, Director of the Risala, the Strategic Studies Institute in Tehran. Now, moving on, the Iraqi army says at least 2 rockets have landed at the Ain al-Assad air base hosting U.S. forces in the western Anbar province. The attack caused no casualties, no further elaboration on that. There is no claim of responsibility either. And this is the 3rd attack against American forces in Iraq in the past 3 days. On Monday, at least 3 rockets hit a military air base hosting U.S. forces north of the capital, Baghdad. On Sunday, 2 rockets targeted an air base at the Baghdad International Airport, housing U.S.-led coalition troops. Raids on U.S. assets in Iraq have risen recently amid growing anti-American sentiment. The United Nations says that rain-triggered floods since mid-April have hit thousands of families across war-torn Yemen. The UN humanitarian agency, OCHA, put the number of affected people at more than 22,000, saying that the majority of them are internally displaced. The intensified rainfall over the past few days has caused damage to infrastructure, destroying homes, and leaving casualties. A Monday Yemeni media reported at least 5 deaths in flash floods that hit the historic city of Tara. Yemen has been devastated by a settler war that was launched in 2015. The aggression has left tens of thousands of people dead and millions more displaced. And the UN is saying that Yemen is suffering the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Official figures show the number of crimes committed by right-wing extremists reached a record high in post-war Germany last year. And that figure, based on police records, suggests over 23,600 crimes of a far-right nature were committed in 2020. That's a jump of over 5% on the previous year. and the highest since records began in 2001. Representative figures, Interior Minister Horst Seehofer, described the right-wing extremism as the biggest threat to his country. He also cited the 2020 deadly racist attack in Hanau. According to the Victims Association, the attacks mainly targeted refugees, migrants, and black Germans. Anti-Asian violence has also increased since the beginning of the pandemic in March 2020. India's total COVID infections have soared past 20 million, and this after reporting some 357,000 new cases in one day. India's caseload is the second largest in the world, and that after the United States. The country is facing deadly second wave of the disease after the virus surged recently. The government has been reluctant to impose a national lockdown due to the economic fallout. Opposition leader Rahul Gandhi says that the government's inaction is killing the people, so has called for the lockdown. The virus surge has caused severe shortages of medicine and oxygen supplies. Hospitals have been overstretched. A number of countries have sent aid to India to help it contain the health crisis. Munawwar Zaman says that the Indian government has ignored medical experts' warnings about the wave of COVID-19.
Many cases are going unreported because there's a lot of queues outside the crematoriums, and there are not just people who die in the hospitals. There are many people who die in home quarantine, and they are not being registered in the government data. So we cannot trust the data completely that the government is giving us. So we just have to wait for proper data tonight. If the government comes with latest figures, then I've spoken with many experts either. They're saying that the government's failure also to avoid the crisis is one of the biggest problems that this country is facing, because many scientists in the month of January has warned the Indian government that the second wave would be disastrous and it would be much dangerous than the first wave. But the report said the government has ignored those scientists as well.
Time now for the news review section. The Scottish First Minister has challenged the British Prime Minister over another independence referendum. Nicola Sturgeon saying that if Boris Johnson wants to prevent such a vote in Scotland, he should take the matter to court. She says that Johnson is not entitled to stand in the way of the democratic choices of the Scottish people. A ruling Scottish National Party, SNP, has pledged to hold a new vote by the end of 2023 if they get a clear lead in the Scottish Parliament and Thursday elections. Opinion polls suggesting that the SNP is heading for an outright majority. Johnson has repeatedly turned down requests for a second independence referendum, which could fracture the UK. He says that the matter was settled for a generation in 2014 when Scotland voted against independence by 55% to 45%. Now, let's discuss this a little bit. We have a couple of guests, one from London, our own Robert Inlikish, joining us, and also we have John White, writer and political analyst in Edinburgh. Good to have both of you on the show. To London, Rob, let's look at from the UK perspective of things, and is Mr. Johnson sticking to his guns when it comes to an independence drive from the Scots?
Well, this would come to a matter of what the law is, of course, but Boris Johnson is going to stick hard to his guns. He has, of course, internal conflict, and he does not want to be the man that's seen as giving away or breaking up the union. Of course, they'll argue from the British perspective that, of course, this was an issue which was solved. It's a once-in-a-generation decision for to have this referendum, but the entire situation has evidently changed. Brexit happened, and the majority of Scots voted to stay in the European Union. So the Boris Johnson government administration is trying to have it both ways, essentially. And as he is in such trouble internally, what's happening due to the policies coming out of Westminster, it looks very much negative for Boris Johnson at this point. And despite what he tries to do, if the SNP is going to pull through in the elections come Thursday, then it looks like it's heading towards a defeat for Boris Johnson politically.
Okay. Now, John, what do you expect could be the result of the election, and do you believe that SNP can pull this through and get what they want?
Well, the polls indicate that the SNP is on course to win the election and to enjoy an overall majority in the Scottish Parliament. And that would be very significant because that would set in train a move towards a second referendum on independence, which Johnson, as we just heard, is doing his damnedest to block. But I think the momentum is really now behind independence in Scotland, despite the ravages of COVID, because people have seen the bungling of COVID by the Johnson administration, and they've also seen the way that Johnson has refused to include Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's First Minister, in any of the top-level discussions on the planning of COVID regulations and their rollout. And essentially, the constituent parts of the UK, Wales, the north of Ireland, England and Scotland have been governing themselves when it comes to COVID. Regulations in Scotland have differed from regulations in England, and increasingly Boris Johnson's legitimacy is that of the Prime Minister of England, not the Prime Minister of the UK.
Okay, and John, will Boris Johnson go as far as taking the matter into court, or will he give up?
No, he's not going to give up. He's going to try and delegitimize any move towards a second referendum. The stakes are too high. He does not want to be the Prime Minister who's seen as quote-unquote losing Scotland. And of course, if the UK does break up, then the UK's standing on the international stage will be grievously affected, particularly in the eyes of its US ally. And of course, we have to state, and we have to include in this discussion, the future of Trident nuclear missiles, which are stationed on the west coast of Scotland. And a key policy, a red line policy of the SNP, is that as soon as Scotland becomes independent, then those Trident missiles will be destroyed, or they'll be removed from Scottish soil. And Britain's nuclear deterrence, so-called, is the means by which it enjoys its status as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. So the stakes could not be higher for the UK, and that's why Boris Johnson and the Tory establishment is setting its face so firmly and so rigorously against a second referendum on Scottish independence.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Robert Enlicus joined us from London, and John White, writer and political analyst from Edinburgh. Moving on with the rest of this news broadcast, Iran has reported more coronavirus infections and hundreds of new related deaths despite strict measures in place across the nation. The health ministry is saying that 344 more people succumbed to the disease in the past day, pushing the tally to 73,000. Iran has seen a relative decline in fatalities, and that after registering over 400 daily deaths in the past week, authorities have logged 20,000 new cases, taking the infections to more than 2.5 million. The government imposed the restrictions last month following a steep rise in deaths and infections. Health experts blame the UK variant for the sharp rise. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson: what type of fast am I keeping? Let us take a pause and think that if our fast breaking, eating, and drinking are done for the sake of pleasure, especially if they are accompanied with overeating, then this will be tantamount to an animal act, of course. If it was arranged through lawful means and lawful income, and if it consists of forbidden means and forbidden money, then in that case, it will be even lower and degrading. But this same fast breaking, eating, and drinking, if it is done with the intention of obedience of divine command, for having the required physical strength in order to be able to engage in worship, thus attaining Allah's nearness, then in that case, it will be tantamount to the deeds of prophets, imams, and angels. Therefore, we must be careful and must strive that our eating and drinking should be like those of the prophets and imams and not like those of the animals and beasts. Because the prophets and imams, even though enjoy eating and drinking as per the dictates of their human nature, nevertheless pursue far deeper intentions and objectives. Brothers and sisters, at the end of the day, it is in our hands. There are different types of fasts. There's this one fast which will just get us off the hook, and then there is this other fast that will take us way closer to the seerah and the lives and the way of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. And these are the fasts of our urafa and mystics. So let's try to improve the quality of our fasting so we can gain the maximum benefit.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing what type of fast am I keeping? And we said there are different types and classifications of fasting. Some people fast, you know, while they just stay hungry and thirsty and they, you know, abstain from a few actions which are considered to be invalidators of fast. But then there are those saints of Allah, those servants of Allah who fast the way they should be fasting, and that is that they don't even have thoughts of someone who thinks about violating the laws of Allah or thinks about anything other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And if they do anything, it is with the intention of seeking that nearness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the important deeds of the last night of the holy month of Ramadan is self-scrutinizing, and it would be so much better and desirable that at the end of the month, the fast-observing believer should audit his investment and profit. Exactly like two partners who scrutinize their investment and gains at the end of the day. He should look at his investment, that is, age, faith, blessings, and illuminations of the holy month of Ramadan, and should find out whether at the end of the month his faith in Allah, the glorious, the exalted, the holy prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam, and religion has increased or not. One should gauge his ethics and his spiritual condition. Brothers and sisters, this evaluation is very important and very beneficial. Let's not make the month of Ramadan a habit that comes every year and we face it, we live through it, and then as a habit, we fall into another Ramadan the following year. Let's try to maximize the benefit from this blessed month. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You know that I will be better, that I will be stronger if you are by my side.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though, as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but as we see in this documentary, it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime. And we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income. And this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I go, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context, so that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Vinny, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American Dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American Dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there, but, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
This Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arile and Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer, and of course he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate, and he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arile, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid he was winning things at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run, to chase, to rustle are to chase, I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
So I know you'd like to jump in, but we're just going to pause just for a second as we take a look at another clip from Gunrunners, which shows Robert Mutanda tell us about the significance of marathon running.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find it difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you'll be in a hot soup. Look outside, the people are running. Town breathes, eats, sleeps, imagines, fantasizes, everything.
The arts, one out of 10, that you can make money out of it. And one in the 50, to really make money out of it, you start really changing your life.
The luck of getting a manager that supports you and brings you to races for around a 15% commission is crucial.
There is a big boulevard of broken dreams here in Niger. A big one, a big, big, big one. But some people walk over the boulevard of broken dreams, still thinking they can make it.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Relay. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Relay's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Relay is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here. But it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. And but what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out from in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflicts. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete, and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's Old Town Square in this historic city.
Is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it and stuff. So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. It's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
Sure. It's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way, in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.